From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. The AT&T Time Warner merger, the end of Roger Ailes, Disney wins movies, Netflix aims for world domination. It's a mega news banter year in review. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am here with my regular banter partners, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter and Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety. A lot of ground to cover, guys. So much happened this year. So much may yet happen with the little teeny bit that's left. Let's start with merger activity, because this industry is going through big changes, as both of you know. There's consolidation underway, and in some cases, there was maybe going to be consolidation. I'm talking about CBS and Viacom, a deal that is not going to happen, but we'll start with AT&T, Time Warner. We don't quite know if that deal is happening yet, but certainly it looks like it will, and that is a huge change.
Yeah, I think ultimately it will happen in 2017, and if so, this would be an $85 billion merger of AT&T, one of the big telecom companies, and Time Warner, perhaps the most prolific of the pure content companies with HBO, Warner Brothers, the Turner Networks. This gives an enormous amount of power to the AT&T shareholders, but as AT&T argued in front of Congress, they feel they need this power in order to go up against the even bigger powers of the tech community.
And of course, this kind of thing puts a shiver through anybody who's not gigantic.
Yeah, I mean, it one-ups this whole race to get big. And the question is, how is that going to play out in the rest of the industry? You've already seen this year, Starz and Lionsgate agreed to merge. That's a large television company merging with, perhaps the largest mini independent studio to better compete with the majors. You've seen a lot of activity in the China front, where these Chinese companies like Wanda are coming in to try to put together a bunch of assets like Legendary Pictures and Dick Clark Productions to create its own big company. You would have seen it with CBS and Viacom, which many believe would be merged back together. They were once. The Redstone family has declared that they're not going to pursue that. But I think that 2017 is likely going to see more of this activity in the race to get big.
And obviously, you've already seen AT&T get bigger in the entertainment world with its merger with DirecTV, and now combining that distribution platform with the product of Time Warner with those networks, it brings up a lot of the same questions that we had with the Comcast-NBC Universal merger, but even on a bigger scale.
Now, Warner Brothers has been trying to make an argument that they are doing great. The analogy I would use is that they have got some good ground beef. It is not filet. They want us to think it's filet. But, specifically on the movies, they have had some success with DC Comics. Batman versus Superman did a big number. So did Suicide Squad. They had Fantastic Beasts. Let's not forget Fantastic Beasts. It's a good launch for them. But what they're not doing is doing what Disney has done, which is to hit movie after movie over the fence. I mean, at the end of the year now, we're seeing Moana in theaters doing a giant number. They have Doctor Strange doing a giant number. And as we are taping, we don't know where it will come out. But Rogue One, I feel confident, will do a giant number. And Warner Brothers simply has not been able to get to $1 billion, even with Batman versus Superman. I think if AT&T, this deal closes, that is going to be addressed.
Yeah, I think you should give Warner some credit, though. The Fantastic Beasts launch, which is very important to them because they've greenlit 5 movies based on this property by J.K. Rowling. I think they are happy with this. It's probably going to get to 800, 900, which is, for a franchise starter, that's a pretty good number. But
although it's not an absolute pure franchise starter, it's playing off of Harry Potter.
True, but they have reintroduced this property for a new
credit
generation of movies. Yes,
mm-hmm, fair enough.
But, the elephant or the giant mouse in the room, if you want to use the analogy, is Disney. I mean, they could end this year with 24-25% of the domestic box office market share, which is extraordinary for one studio. And this plan that they have put in place where they have these movies delivered by their silos, whether it's Pixar, Disney Animation, Marvel, or the live action studio, or Lucasfilm, they have this pipeline of movies that is going to last 5-10 years down the line. And if I was another studio, I would be terrified about this. At the holidays, you've got a Star Wars. Memorial weekend, you've got a Marvel movie. You've got Disney coming out with 2 movies a year in the animation space. It's an extraordinary pipeline of product. you know, they say the movie business is the riskiest business in the world. They have almost made it a non-risky business.
Yeah, well, certainly for now they have. And we're going to circle back to Disney and the TV stuff in a second. But before we do, I do want to talk about CBS Viacom. That, you know, that seemed like a deal that was going to make Leslie Moonves, you know, Mike, you know, God of television.
Right, right. But, you know, there was always sort of the yin and yang of that. You know, did he really want it? You know, he's got a good thing going right now with CBS as a standalone operation. It's really humming. They don't have all that unnecessary debt that comes with being larger. And of course, the Viacom networks are in trouble. They're going to continue to be in trouble for a while. There's no real game plan yet to turn around some of those major properties like MTV or Comedy Central. And, you know, if you're Leslie Moonves, you need that headache at this point in your career.
I would argue that he would be happy to have that headache if he could have gotten it for the number that he felt was fair to CBS shareholders. Because I think Leslie Moonves does not see himself retiring right now. You know, we see a lot of these guys, like Alan Horn at Disney is over 70. They don't see themselves going anywhere. Yeah. I think Leslie Moonves is certainly first rank of that.
But he is starting to think about his legacy. And what if you can't turn around MTV?
I think he would have had to definitely roll up his sleeves. At this point, the bigger issue really seems to me to be that Viacom is too weak right now for them to reach a deal where Leslie Moonves can go to his shareholders and say, we did well for you. If it's a bad deal, the Viacom shareholders will be like, hey, you sold us out. So Viacom needs to take some vitamins. I think that's the hope of Shari Redstone, who says, along with her 93-year-old father, Sumner, is going to be in charge of this thing. You know, she's the one who's mobile and out in the world. So she and Bob Bakish, who will run Viacom, is like unlikely character. He was the international TV guy, Mike. Is that what the title was? I don't even actually have that in my head.
Yeah, he was very under the radar for years. So, yeah.
So he gets to be CEO. It's like, surprise, you wake up and you're the CEO of Viacom. He certainly has his work cut out for him. And if he can bulk it up, his reward may be that they revisit this down the road and Leslie Moonves takes over regardless.
My question is, are they going to shed assets? Do you think that keeping these companies separate will require either Viacom or CBS, probably Viacom, to sell Paramount Pictures, sell MTV, sell Nickelodeon, do something to kind of shake things up?
I think from where I sit, and this is a very fluid live story as we're speaking right now, I do not see Shari Redstone permitting the sale of Paramount Pictures. That is a crown jewel, certainly for her father. I think these things matter to her as his daughter. You don't sell even a stake in Paramount. From what I hear right now, they will have to take a look at the networks. They'll shake up MTV.
Well, they shook up MTV how many times?
It's been right, shaking
again,
for a few years
still.
Now.
Yeah, yeah. It's gone through three different heads of programming just over the past 2 years.
But I think Shari Redstone has decided that she actually seems to be pleasantly surprised. She likes Bob Bakish, this guy that none of us had ever had on our radar. She kind of found him when she ousted Philippe Domon as one of the big stories of the year we haven't even talked about. The battle that she waged to oust this person who had been basically like a son to her father by her father's own account and the future when he was in the right mood. Sometimes he was, sometimes he wasn't. But Philippe Domon was running Viacom very badly, I think, by broad consensus on Wall Street and in the industry. And Shari Redstone, she would say her father did this, but somehow or another, major battle, horrible litigation, and she emerged with Philippe Domon out.
The question I have for Viacom, and specifically in the cable network side, is what is the digital strategy for Viacom? Because you have all of these other conglomerates that are investing in this space and that are developing direct-to-consumer apps and other digital products. What is Viacom doing?
Yeah, and the clock is ticking. I mean, one of the big terms of 2016 is skinny bundle, of course, and we're seeing, you know, a number of, you know, from DirecTV Now to Sling to a number of these services that are going to be coming online in the coming years, and we're all going to see some real attrition of these cable networks. So yeah, maybe MTV doesn't go away, maybe Comedy Central doesn't go away, but a lot of the supporting players that, you know, added money
aren't really supporting that much.
But, you know, nonetheless got subscription fees. Those networks go away and suddenly the bottom line goes down even further.
I think that's one of the reasons Les Moonves will not cry over not having this right now is because he has a very clean thing to sell, CBS and Showtime. And he doesn't have to junk it up with stuff that cable system operators don't want and will push back on and try to say, you know, how about this network that nobody watches?
And honestly, he looks even forward thinking with CBS All Access, which is not perfect. It's a very small over-the-top play, but nonetheless, it makes CBS look forward thinking. And they're doing some really interesting things over there, including this new, you know, Star Trek series, this new Good Wife series. They finally can stream NFL finally. recently on CBS All Access as well. It's a nice little play that's sort of, you know, their foot in the sand until they really figure out what their digital plan is.
But CBS isn't immune to the problems that are besetting a lot of these networks. I mean, if you look at the ratings for this season, it's down another double digits, including at CBS, which is right. down a lot.
Yeah, it's
bad. And the question I have is there a bottom for broadcast network ratings? Have we seen it yet? And when is the financial hit going to start to take place against these networks? Because we really haven't seen it quite that much. Every year they announce, oh, record upfront sales. And when is that going to start to take a hit?
Yeah, well, we've been asking that question, I mean, honestly, for two decades now. And we haven't seen it bottom out just yet. So that's a very good question. And ironically, as the audiences get smaller, the dollar signs get bigger because they need to, you know, capture more to get the same amount of audience that they did before.
So let's circle back on Disney, which I said we would come back to, and ESPN, Mike. The movie side just dazzling. And then there's this drag on that company that almost feels unfair when they're doing so well in the movies.
Right. Well, and it does seem kind of unfair because, you know, ESPN is such a behemoth and, you know, it provides so much to the bottom line. I mean, we first have to acknowledge that ESPN is still a tremendous property and still a huge part of Disney. But yeah, nonetheless, you know, I mentioned skinny bundles, and that's part of the impact that we're seeing on ESPN is, you know, there's a segment of the population that doesn't watch sports.
That would be me.
Yeah, and so you're a perfect
customer. I've been complaining about this for years
on the air. For a skinny bundle that doesn't have ESPN, and there's a segment of the population that can now call up and say, I don't want my ESPN, and we're starting to see that really have an impact on the levels. But, you know, it's not just ESPN. A number of cable networks have actually seen their distribution go down this year as people move. Either they cut the cord, or, of course, we've heard all about this generation of millennials that are cord nevers, and they're finding new ways to get their programming. So, yeah, when ESPN is that large and has that much of an impact on Disney, when it takes a hit, it's felt throughout the company.
And the thing that's really hurt ESPN is sort of the death of the highlight. I mean, if you look at how people are consuming sports content now, most of the major leagues now have apps. Every night when I used to tune into Baseball Tonight, I now look at my phone and bring up the exact highlights I want to see. That's a big problem for ESPN because SportsCenter for many years was the flagship program. Its ratings are way down. And ESPN is saddled with these gigantic sports league fees that they pay to air Monday Night Football and the College Bowl Series. And yes, those generate big ratings and they're very lucrative for them. But the costs at ESPN are so enormous, they've been propped up by these high subscriber fees. And if, you know, even a 10 million subscriber loss for ESPN would be pretty significant if they don't have a digital strategy that makes that up. Yeah. And I think they do. And I think in 2017, we will see more of what ESPN's direct-to-consumer experience is going to be like. But as of now, it's understandable why these shareholders are upset.
One thing that I think seems to not be a thing, correct me if I'm wrong, we talked about how football seemed to be losing traction, and that was a really bad sign. But from what I'm seeing recently, am I right, the ratings are back in a big way?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was some sense that the election just, you know, really a lot of people were distracted by this crazy election, which, by the way, we haven't even mentioned the T word yet in this, this broadcast, amazingly enough. But
how is that possible?
I don't know. But, you know, obviously, I think that really was a distraction and played into some of this. I mean, there were a number of factors.
Well, the numbers bear it out. If you look at the year that cable news has been having, yeah, the numbers are records. And, you know, that audience is not coming out of thin air. It's coming from somewhere. And if you looked at what football broadcasts were hurt most during the first half of the season, it was those prime time, you know, weeknight especially broadcasts, the time that people are tuning into cable news.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, the little bit of weak games. Also, there is a question of oversaturation with the Thursday games especially, but it does seem like politics and the election was sort of the deciding factor in those numbers going down.
Certainly, that's what the networks
hope.
I think
a big test will be the Super Bowl. If we see a significant drop in the Super Bowl this year, then I think the NFL will start to panic.
So while we're on the subject of TV and challenges that are facing TV, one of the big ones is streaming services, and of course, Netflix above all. Netflix is spending money, so much money.
So much money. $6 billion a year in programming. Of course, that's not just original programming. That's also acquisitions and library. But nonetheless, that's a huge payday.
So what you had with Netflix initially was the studios taking old TV shows and saying, whoopee, we have a buyer for this thing that we thought was not that valuable. And then they fed what turned into a giant monster. And right now, they're anxious about even selling to them, even though they're sort of strung out on the Netflix money, because Netflix is almost saying, you know, we're coming to drink your milkshake.
Well, it's that term frenemy that I think we heard a lot from network executives, because you're right. This paid for quite a bit of programming at the networks, at the studios. You know, Netflix is now promising to double their output next year.
Crazy.
At some point, it's just too much programming, right? But we've been also complaining about too much TV for a number of years, and that's not going away. At some point, they're going to just stop acquiring.
Global domination.
And they're going to stop acquiring library product because they have enough of their own.
Yeah, they're making originals, and that's the threat.
Yeah, they want to own. Like everyone in the TV business, the goal is ownership now, not licensing, ownership. And Netflix is being very aggressive. They're paying higher prices to talent to get that ownership on a global basis, which the talent is, in most cases, very eager to take these record prices that are being paid. Now, down the line.
It's a trade-off. It's a sure thing. They pay you up front. And if your show turns out to be The Big Bang Theory, guess what? You left millions of dollars on the table because there's no afterlife for you as a participant in the profits. It's all belongs to Netflix.
And of course, you'll never know if your show became The Big Bang
because
Theory
they will
because
not tell
they'll
you.
Never show you those numbers. Right. So who knows?
Right. And I think that the challenge there for Netflix is this is all being funded by the Netflix subscriber base, which they have a mandate to grow that global subscriber base, and it does keep going up and up and up. If that subscriber base starts to level off or decline, or there are competitors around the world that get serious about this.
And, we're looking you know, at you, Amazon.
Yeah, or others,
or others
that start to bite into this. There is likely a point where the stock price and the value of the company no longer jibes with the spending that they are doing. And I wonder when or if that will happen soon.
Yeah, well, they're going to run out of countries at some point, right?
True.
I mean, it's sort of, we saw that interestingly on the cable side. At some point, they reached critical mass when it came to subscribers. 100 million was about the limit that you could get, and you started to see the cable networks having to, you know, duck and weave, and that's where we ran into problems with the Viacom networks and what have you. So the interesting question with Netflix will be, at that point when they finally reach critical mass and they can't grow anymore subscription-wise, have they cut out all of that acquisition, that library content at that point, and maybe they're not spending $6 billion a year, maybe they're spending $3 billion or $2
billion. Or they have such market dominance that they can just raise the price.
Well, there's that too. I mean, I think that one thing that I sense, and it's just a feeling right now, is that Hollywood doesn't love it when anyone becomes too powerful. And there's a sort of a rumbling in this industry of how do we bring Netflix down a notch? I don't know whether Hollywood can still mount a challenge to something like Netflix, but I feel like there's a, not an organized effort, but a sort of a feeling that people want to challenge Netflix.
Well, and you're seeing it in the film world. Talent wants their film distributed in theaters. Directors want to see their movie in a screen, and Amazon is offering that. They're offering to put films in theaters like Manchester by the Sea and the Woody Allen film, then put it on Amazon. Netflix is not offering that, and you're seeing a lot of these big movies gravitate towards Amazon and not Netflix because of that fact.
And I have to say, it baffles me why Netflix refuses to consider it. It's obviously hugely important to filmmakers, and the word will go out among filmmakers that, you know, maybe you have remorse when you've made your film and you realize it's not going to be in theaters, which I understand has happened in at least one case with a major filmmaker. That's the thing about Netflix. It's a Silicon Valley kind of culture. This culture is more touchy-feely, and I'll send you a gift basket when your show launches. Netflix doesn't call or write when the show launches. And I think Hollywood's culture is very entrenched in that regard.
Yeah, but, you know, money talks.
Money
and
does
talk. If Netflix is willing to pay you $5 million more to make the movie, maybe your concerns about the gift basket go away.
Right. And I think
it would help me, I've got to tell you.
I think on the TV side, Netflix is acting much more like a network these days. You know, you are hearing a little bit more about notes, and there is sort of this, you know, traditionalness that's creeping in, for better or for worse.
Coming up after a short break, Megyn Kelly brings down the seemingly invincible Roger Ailes. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
And I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're taking stock of the industry as we wrap up 2016. I'm here with Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety and Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Now, it's taken us a while to get to one of the biggest stories of the year, which is Fox and Roger Ailes. I mean, that was a development that you could not have foreseen. Obviously, I am referring to Gretchen Carlson. She was dismissed from Fox. She then sued Roger Ailes personally, not Fox, accused him of retaliating against her for various things, including not playing along with his advances, his sexual advances in the workplace. And then there was immediately Fox said, we're going to investigate this. And certain people came to the defense of Roger Ailes, but the notable person who was missing, there was one notable person, Mike, who was not part of that.
Right. Megyn Kelly. The second that they lost Megyn Kelly, they lost Roger Ailes.
Absolutely. She brought down Roger Ailes.
Well, and it wasn't just that she didn't come forward. I mean, she later revealed that she affirmatively went to Fox and revealed some sexual advances that Roger Ailes had made on her in her career. And when that happened, he was out.
I mean, what we have is a dynamic where Rupert Murdoch has brought his sons, Lachlan and James, into the fold. And we have long heard that Lachlan and James may not quite be the big fans of Roger Ailes that their dad is.
Or Fox News in general.
And politically, maybe not so conservative as that. And Lachlan in particular had, tough encounters with Roger Ailes when he had been in the company earlier in his career and Roger Ailes had been very inhospitable to him, which shows you how big of a deal Roger Ailes was, that he had created this juggernaut Fox News and he could be dismissive of his boss's son. So then Lachlan left for a time, came back, and it felt a little bit like, okay, now we have the upper hand a little bit. And when you say you're going to bring in, and Matt, you're actually a lawyer, we're going to bring in an outside law firm to investigate, which is immediately what they said when Gretchen Carlson sued. We're going to investigate with outside counsel. That means the rug, it's not going to be so easy to get that mess swept under it.
Absolutely. I mean, Fox News had operated for decades now as its own kind of almost like a little political organization within a giant
black ops organization.
Yeah, right. Giant media company.
And I'm going to say shout out to Gabriel Sherman, the journalist who exposed a great deal of this, but go ahead.
Yeah. So when this happened and it was a public lawsuit and with some pretty explosive allegations, it makes sense. This happens a lot. Companies will bring in an outside law firm. It doesn't necessarily mean that won't be a sham or a sort of, rubber stamping effort. And I think a lot of people initially were like, okay, well, what is this law firm actually doing? But it became pretty clear that they were going to people and soliciting input. And people like Megyn Kelly were coming forward with information. And once that happened, that's the proper procedure to say, okay, Roger, we've got to talk about a settlement agreement. And our understanding is that the settlement agreement is $40 million or more for him to go away, which is why you have never seen since that, you have not seen Roger Ailes talk about Gretchen Carlson or anything when he does, his very limited press that he has done. It's usually to defend himself against allegations that are made against him. But he was paid a lot of money to go away. Some say too much for some of the allegations that were made against him. But
the allegations were awful, I should just say. I mean, really awful, awful behavior with women.
Right. For many, many years. And a lot of these women came forward after this lawsuit was filed.
Some cases, risking a lawsuit for breaking a non-disclosure agreement after having settled with Fox.
Absolutely. And I think if you look at the big picture of 21st Century Fox and the Murdoch sons and their role in this, I think they likely saw in this, first of all, an untenable situation. You can't have this guy there when these kind of allegations are made against him. You have to make a change. And secondly, I think they really saw it as an opportunity. This is someone who has been aligned for many years with their father, who has been openly hostile to them, and has created this organization that, according to people we talk to, they're not 100% proud of all the time.
They being the Murdoch sons. Young men.
Now, they're all probably pretty proud of the $1 billion a year in profit that it generates, and they've been very happy to accept that money. But in the best case scenario, they now have a chance to remake Fox News with new leadership, turn it into much more of a more mainstream news organization, while in their minds, hopefully, keeping that conservative-leaning audience via the commentators that they have on the show, on the network, and have the best of both worlds.
I don't know,
I don't know if that's going to work out.
I wouldn't go as far as mainstream. I mean, you look at Ailes' replacements, basically his lieutenants who took over are continuing the voice and the spirit of Fox News. You know, the question was, you know, was Fox News bigger than Roger Ailes? For the longest time, we thought, no, that Fox News couldn't survive without Roger Ailes. But basically, you bring in his lieutenants to continue business mostly as normal.
And which was their father who did that. Rupert personally said, I'm stepping in and handling this.
Right. And, you know, what's also fascinating is all of this happened rather swiftly at the same time that we saw the rise to power of Donald Trump, of course.
Who has been openly hostile with the network in this kind of back and forth. He needs them and he likes them, but he knows that he got a lot of political capital from criticizing them again.
Especially Megyn
right. Kelly, exactly. And Rupert Murdoch has said some negative things about Trump on Twitter. So there is this, it's an interesting time for Fox News because after two decades of being the undisputed voice of the conservative movement, they have a president now who sometimes agrees with them, sometimes doesn't.
President-elect, not quite in there yet.
Sorry, president-elect. Sometimes, you know, loves Sean Hannity, doesn't love Megyn Kelly, sometimes loves Bill O'Reilly, sometimes, you know, says mean things. So it's a very interesting dynamic.
Right. They'll still be much more the voice of this administration than, say, CNN or MSNBC or The New York Times or any other number of publications that Donald Trump decides to tweet about on a daily basis.
Just back to Fox for a question, Mike. Yeah. I mean, do Sean Hannity and Megyn Kelly exist under the same roof?
Well, that's the big question as we wait and see what happens with Megyn Kelly's contract.
I think my prediction is she doesn't. I believe she's going to leave. I think that no network will pay her the $20 million that she wants, but they'll get pretty close.
Yeah.
And she'll go to CNN or she'll go to ABC News and, you know, get promised some specials in addition to, you know, a nightly show, or she'll get some kind of rich deal elsewhere. And the reason will be the climate at Fox News is pretty hostile towards her. And I think Hannity is one of the main reasons behind that.
Okay, we'll see what happens with Megyn Kelly. I just want to turn to the issue of diversity, which has, you know, last year we had Oscars So White. Oscars is not as white this year by a long shot. Moonlight very much in contention. TV, however, I think remains the real leader, right, Mike,
in diversity. TV's been impressive for the past couple of years, and it continues. When you look at some of the biggest shows of 2016, People versus O.J., very diverse, won plenty of Emmys for folks like Courtney B. Vance and Sterling K. Brown, who's one of the big breakouts of the entire year. Not only the star of People versus O.J., but the star of This Is Us, one of the few broadcast bright lights this fall.
So what is impressive? Impressive to me is that there are people in the industry, and I'm speaking specifically right now about Ryan Murphy, because he has made a pledge to make half his directors on his shows women or people of color, and he did do that, and that is putting your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, you have to give credit to Ryan Murphy, but also John Landgraf at FX, and you know, this was
Absolutely.
An issue that came up this year, that there just aren't enough female directors, and the networks and producers
too,
are really responding to that.
Yeah, we saw Channing Dungey become the first African-American president of a major broadcast network, which is amazing that that is the first, but that is the first. I mean, ironically, she made some comments about trying to program more for middle America in the wake of the Trump victory. And I'm like, wait, is this really going to happen?
Yeah, I don't think she quite meant it that broad. I mean, ABC already programs to middle America with shows like The Middle.
Yeah, and I think that when the Oscar nominations are announced this year, there's a good chance that there will be significant minority representation among the acting nominees, which is the key for the Oscars. They cannot have a third year of no people of color in those acting nominations.
Yeah, and I don't think it will happen. We'll see. Thank you, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter and Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety. We will banter in the year ahead.
Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
And that's the business for 2016. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week and next year on The Business.